Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Got a great episode. We're going to talk about a case that was just put out in the press on a unsealed key TAM that's going on now, and super excited to talk about it and sort of the implications in the SIU space and then from the program integrity space. Of course, I've got my two partners in crime, Wade McFall, assistant special agent in charge, parentheses, retired, and now a manager on our SIU investigative team, and Matt Kachansky, special agent in charge, retired, and the retired program director from the Northeast. You pick. And again, I'm Eric Rubenstein, the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here at Advise. Also, senior special agent from New York, retired. So today we're going to talk. There's a key TAM that just got unsealed that involves three of the larger Medicare Advantage plans that are out there. And the key TAM is alleging a kickback scheme and something called cherry picking and lemon dropping. Haven't heard that term in a while. They don't actually call it cherry picking and lemon dropping. We'll talk about what that is in a second. But it involves three of the larger Medicare Advantage offerers that are out there. And for those of you that work from home or have the TV on during the day, during open enrollment period, you see these advertisements for companies that will help you with finding what is the best Medicare Advantage plan for you. You know, you call this 800 number and you get a broker on the phone and they kind of walk you through some steps and then make some recommendations as to which the best plan might be for you. And then you make your decision and they'll help you with the enrollment and all of that. And of course, if you watch these commercials and you pause the commercial and you read the fine print, which no one can ever read, unless you pause the commercial, take a picture of it, and then blow it up on your phone because the print is so tiny, it basically says that they're providing you with unbiased and unscathed information, right? And for lack of a better term, and helping you to pick it. And what we are seeing from reading this key TAM, it's about a 200-page key TAM that comes from an individual who worked for one of these brokers on TV. And files this key TAM on behalf of the government, alleging that there was, among other things, a kickback arrangement, meaning that the broker companies were being paid for generating, not only generating the leads, but for sending over people for enrollment into these Medicare Advantage plans. And it's millions and millions of dollars. Where they get into what's called cherry picking and lemon dropping, which you can't do, is that you cannot deny a person entrance into a Medicare Advantage plan based upon prior conditions or anything along those lines. And so what this key TAM is alleging, and again, this is just an allegation, but what the key TAM is alleging is that people with certain medical conditions were being steered away from certain plans that were paying kickbacks. And that's known as lemon dropping, where you're getting rid of the sickest people, and cherry picking, meaning putting the healthiest people, right? So in the Medicare Advantage space, the sicker people are, the more comorbidities they have, the higher their risk score, and the more money it costs on what they call the per member per month for that member. If you have people that are healthy, it costs the Medicare Advantage plan less. And then they keep what's called their medical loss ratio numbers very much in line. They make more money and they're not having to pay out a lot of money. And so it's in a Medicare Advantage or any sort of an HMO's best interest, obviously, to have the healthiest people and not create issues of financial or fiscal issues for other plans. And so those are kind of the two big issues. And obviously, I'm a little bit long-winded and I apologize, but obviously the importance of having these services, it really does exist. There is an actual need for people that don't know it. During open enrollment, in the Medicare Part D space, you know, drug benefit, there are thousands of plans around the country, and it can be a challenge. And some recent surveys, I looked at one recently, Kaiser Family Foundation put out something that in 2024, during the open enrollment period in 2024, the average Medicare beneficiary had 43 different Medicare Advantage plans to choose from. And the number of Medicare Advantage plans has doubled since 2018 in that sense. So whereas in 2018, someone had only about 20 options, they now have well over 40 options. And so that presents inherent challenges with trying to figure out what's the best option. So there is a role for these. CMS has some very strict guidance on how you pay for these broker services. And and how much you can pay and what the caps are and commissions and things of that, and how you can pay for things like sales and marketing and all of that. But it's very tightly controlled. Siemens came out with some updated guidance in the spring of 2024, I believe, that kind of, added to that. So, it is an issue. And I don't think anybody should think that there isn't a kickback arrangement going on behind the scenes involving some of the stuff involving Medicare, right? We don't see a lot of it. And I'm not just talking about Medicare Advantage. We're talking about kickbacks just being a general kind of criminal activity that goes on that's a challenge. And so, Wade, key TAMs are an important part. We talk about key TAMs all the time on our podcast. We talk about the importance of them. We've talked about, from the OIG perspective, the importance of key TAMs and things of that sort. Now, while this particular key TAM may not have implications to the commercial or the Medicaid payer space and the SIU space, right? This is something where, globally, SIUs should be looking at key TAMs when they are published. And there's an intervention by the government, no different than any other press release, because it is a way of gathering intelligence. And while not necessarily this particular key TAM that was unsealed will have implications for a commercial SIU, certainly things that you can pull from a key TAM that you can glean. And even in the kickback space, there are ways to take a look at some data and look at some things and make some identification of things that we would say are indicia of not passing the investigator stink test, right? And looking at a key TAM with a grain of salt, this key TAM, again, may not have implications for the commercial SIU space, but understanding and reading the regulations and looking at what's out there could certainly go a long way for an investigator to hone their craft.
Right. And I think it's important too to maybe step back and just kind of review like relators, what the value of them, what the value of a relator is. It's very similar to like a cooperating witness, but different motivations. Like a relator, most likely is the motivation is money. They're going to get a take, a percentage of whatever the government recovers. Some might argue that their motivation is they're just trying to do the right thing. They're seeing something that's not right, kickbacks. So they're reporting it to the government, whereas a witness is working off exposure that they have been jammed up with. But so a good relator has direct knowledge of the scheme. They're on the inside, basically. They're able to articulate what's going on, and they have firsthand knowledge. The other aspect of it that's important, I think, is they have. Having a relator that has good counsel that is able to coach them on what to do prior to bringing the case to the government and what to do once it's been brought to the government. One of the important aspects of that is they have access to, excuse me, documentation such as emails, text messages, maybe even voice recordings, that as long as they have those in their possession ahead of time, ahead of bringing it to the government, they can provide that to the government. So that's very valuable information that you'll never get using traditional, investigative tools and techniques. So if they have emails where it's communications between them and somebody that they're working with, where they don't think that the government is listening, so they're usually a little bit more free to speak freely, and that's very important, especially in trying to prove intent. But once the case has been shared with the government, they can no longer go back and try and get information like that. So it's they can't be acting on behalf of the
Right.
government as an agent to the government. So it's important, again, for the relator to know that ahead of time, and for their attorney to tell them, look, keep all the emails you have, all the text messages, if you happen to record any conversations, have all that available to provide to the government, because once we speak with them, that part of the your investigative, insight is over with. So that's kind of a thumbnail as to how they get information that we just would not be able to get with traditional methods. So it's again, like you're saying, a lot of times an SIU can't directly, take advantage of these, but reading those where there is insider information, they're able to maybe kind of learn from it and possibly even reach out to the agent and have some conversations with them. But again, the importance of the QTAM is really the relationship that the relator has with his peers or his coworkers prior to coming to the government, so that he can, he or she can have information passed on to the government that is really not likely to be able to be gleaned from other, you know, avenues or tools that we use.
Sure. But so let's talk a little bit about, you know, in the SIU context where there's, you know, where there's the potential of there being a kickback case and you don't have a relator, you don't have anything like that. But, you know, from that SIU perspective, the data can sometimes give you some indications of things that don't pass the stink test, right? So what are some things that investigators, when they're looking at data and they're potentially looking at referral patterns and things of that sort, what are some of the things that are kind of those overt red flags that come up that say, hey, you know, this may be a problem?
Well, I think it's a lot of it is kind of common sense, where we've talked before about if you have like a provider in a certain geographical area and the data is showing that they're getting patients or members from, you know, long distance away from the actual provider's location. It's like, why would these members be traveling, you know, whatever the X miles, 50 miles to this clinic when they're passing, you know, maybe 10 other clinics that can provide the same procedures or services? What's the purpose of them going past all those and traveling this great distance to a certain clinic or provider? That might be a flag that they're getting some kind of incentive to go there. One example, same thing with different maybe prescriptions. It's like, why does one provider provide the same prescriptions, medications that's far above their peers to all their members or all their patients? Again, that's something that there's probably an incentive for them to do that. It's not, and there could be reasons where it's a new drug and the physician is, you know, a champion for it and he thinks it's like this new great thing, but you have to look at it with an open mind that there's probably some kind of incentive, probably a monetary incentive. Maybe it's just because they get more referrals for the members. They're able to charge, you know, the government or insurance company for different procedures based on having these prescriptions. But everything should be looked at kind of with an open mind as to what's the real reason behind it. Is it strictly for better patient care, or is it going to be some kind of financial incentive?
Right. Like, you may have an instance, exactly the point. You may have a pharmacy where they're carrying a particular drug that no one else carries in the neighborhood for whatever reason, and this doctor prescribes that drug, and so you're going there. But, you know, I think we're thinking in terms of something a little bit more nefarious. Doctors in California, why is the DME supplier or whoever it is they're referring the work to in, you know, Wisconsin or or New York or wherever it may be, where, you know, something just doesn't seem right. If it doesn't seem right, it probably isn't right, right? Unless you have a really good viable explanation for it. And so, Matt, you know, the thing that comes up constantly, one of the Medicare Advantage plans that's been named in this current QTAM was the subject of a previous case resulting in a $90 million settlement. And I didn't look to see if there's a corporate integrity agreement or anything along those lines. But this certainly does beg the question of, internally dealing with these issues. And, you know, what we always, if you look at the OIG's guidance on corporate responsibility and corporate citizenship, payment integrity should not report to legal. Payment integrity should report to compliance, because compliance has a direct line to the CEO or the president. Whereas if you go through to legal, there's a layer in there. And oftentimes legal's job is not inherently aligned with compliance, right? Legal's job is to protect the corporate entity. Compliance job is to do the right thing. And so, if you read this QTAM, it appears that in some regards, there may have been some either turning a blind eye. And again, this is all just allegations, right? So we don't know, but clearly all the way up to the top of the food chain, people were complicit in what was going on. But it certainly does beg the question on the importance of making sure that you've got a proper chain of investigative lines. And you know, it kind of then adds in, should compliance be sticking its nose in contractual agreements that are out there? Because the contractual agreement between the payer and these marketing companies would have been through something other than payment integrity. It would have had nothing to do with payment integrity. It would have nothing to do, you know, in that sense. And so the question becomes, you know, how do you deal with that? And then equally as important is, at what point does compliance step away from things, you know, or does compliance get itself involved in everything?
A good compliance program should be involved in everything. And that's why it's one of the hardest jobs there is, because you are always in potential conflict with the other arms of the business because they have their priorities. Compliance has one priority. We have to do things the right way. But in terms of contracts, you know, you referenced the CMS has strict criteria for how these contracts need to be structured with these brokers. So, should compliance be looking at those contracts? Yes, to make sure that they are in compliance with CMS regulations. And I'm sure if they had been doing that, they would have found that they were not, because even just reading the QUTAM, of course, it's allegations. There were structured payments in there that were disguised as X, Y, and Z that even went beyond what CMS was saying could be done, but that were actually just kickbacks. So a compliance program that was looking at those would have caught that. Another thing with compliance, going back to, you know, the relator, most of the time relators are disgruntled former employees that have probably gone forward internally and said, this is going wrong. Without a good compliance program, who are they going to? You know, they're supposed to be the 1-800 number, whatever else it is. That's not available. Who are they turning to? Are they going to the CEO? Are they going to their boss? And their boss is saying, don't worry about it. We're handling it, because they're not in compliance. You know, so you go to someone in compliance, this might have never made the QUTAM because it would have been handled internally. So having that compliance program in place is a huge factor in, you know, the level at which this is going to get resolved. And going
Well,
back
and
to,
that
you
be
know,
well, that becomes the challenge. Like, so the relator in this case was an individual who worked for one of the broker companies on the TV commercial, right? So the first thing is, and I think you hit this right on the head, a lot of relators are former or soon to be former, right? Because they either complained about it and then eventually got silenced, or complained about it and got fired. Or they're people who, whatever the fraud was okay while they were part of it, but then once they were no longer part of it, and that then falls into the disgruntled soon to be former. But that becomes part of the challenge. So, for example, with the broker companies, I would be amazed at what sort of level of compliance the broker companies have. But even if they do have a compliance feature, are you looking in the mirror when you're making your complaint? Because, you know, are you talking to yourself? Because if you're talking about something where, and it, you know, it appears clearly in this QUTAM, and again, these are just the allegations. It's publicly filed. You can look it up. But when you read it, you can see that the relator in this case has like quoted statements that are coming from, you know, there's talks about emails, there's talks about text messages. So this person was in a position where they clearly had the inside scoop on these things. And so the question is, you know, at the end of the day, are you talking to yourself when no one wants to listen to what you've got to say from the compliance perspective? So a little bit of it is an argument of, is an effective compliance program is one that does the work. And so you can say you have a compliance program and a compliance officer, but if they're not doing the work that needs to be done, you wind up just spinning your wheels. It's a little, you know, you're nailing one foot down, walking in a circle and saying, how far did I go today? Because that's all that's happening, is there's nothing going on. That becomes the, you know, part of that challenge. And then on the payer side, the problem on the payer side is always going to be resource allocation for compliance and payment integrity, right? Because a lot of what goes on in compliance goes through payment integrity. And the question is there somebody that's able to do the job of reviewing? Because if we really do it in this global sense, we're talking about somebody looking at all relationships that exist at the vendor level to the payer level, which, you know, regular audits of things like broker contracts and things of that sort, even then, may not tell you the truth. What we're seeing from reading this QITAM is that some of the documents that were executed don't really tell that backstory, but it doesn't absolve anybody of, you know, ultimately that inherent responsibility. So it is a challenge to try to figure this out.
I mean, a good compliance officer is going to be able to understand the numbers as well. If you read that QITAM, the numbers were so skewed in terms of the percentage of the market that particular plans were winning and the percentage of the demographics of the patient population, you know, were skewed to their advantage, that a compliance officer is going to be like, how is this happening? You know, and that's what an SIU should be doing as well, in partnership with the compliance. The compliance officer could bring those numbers to SIU and say, take a look at these. Do these make sense? What could be the possible origin of this? And that starts the investigation. The internal investigation really start looking back at these broker businesses and saying, let's look at the contracts. Let's talk to these people. Let's go witness some of these health fairs that go on, you know, whatever it may be.
Right. Well, doesn't this also then go into, when you're creating the contract, what sort of language are you putting in the contract from a compliance perspective? Meaning, does the payer put into the contract with the broker some information to suggest that there should be a level of transparency? Meaning, hello, broker, how many leads are you getting a month? How many leads is the broker sending to my plan versus Wade's plan versus Matt's plan? What are the metrics for weighing this? Now, I guess at some point, some of that is probably going to be proprietary in nature, but I would still want to know, or at least try to know, if you're a broker, how are you getting these leads, by the way? That's obviously first, because we know for sure that on the Medicare side and things like DME and things of that sort, we know that a lot of that comes from identity theft, from breaches. We know that that's a big thing. So how are these people getting this information? You know, the example I like to give, and I was sharing it with you guys beforehand, is I worked on a case here in New Jersey where the individual set up a sham not-for-profit. And they were using the sham not-for-profit to get into the building, senior citizen buildings, and do talks about free and reduced cost services that his not-for-profit can help with. The fact of the matter is that he wasn't providing anything. He was basically printing up applications for things like, you know, discounted cell phone services, things that were publicly available. But his big thing was he was a Medicare Advantage broker. And what he was doing was he was pitching the Medicare Advantage stuff. So he was soliciting, which you can't do. And then when he was actually sitting in front of prospective Medicare Advantage members, he was having them fill out a solicitation card that was not ever mailed in or anything. And when we did the search warrant at his office, we found thousands of these cards, no postmarks on them, no stamps on them, and they were all in the same handwriting. So there's a lot of nefarious stuff that goes on, which ultimately generate these leads. But I'm thinking in terms of, if I'm the payer, I would want to know, like, what's the impetus for how you're doing this? Now, what we know from the QITAM is that we know where some of these leads are being generated from the brokers, because it's in there. But, you know, is that information that becomes proprietary? I'm saying, if I'm a compliance person, I want to know as much as I can possibly learn it from the contract for the purposes of transparency, to see where these are potentially a problem. I suspect a lot of that would never get into a contract, because if you were going to get that information on how you're doing that business, then the payers can theoretically set up their own companies and do it. You know, or work in partnership as a consortium. I'm sure there's probably some regulatory things, right? Because they can't solicit. And if they're doing these commercials as a third, whatever it may be, you know, we're probably getting a little askew of this, but I would at least want to have some information about what those metrics look like. Because if I'm being heavily weighted or something like that from a compliance perspective, it would be a concern. But this is a two, it's a well over 200 page filing. It's pretty comprehensive. It lays out a lot on the regulatory side of this. It lays out a lot. I mean, my takeaways were really, I don't think I was surprised when I read it. I don't think you guys were surprised when you read it. With so much competition in the Medicare Advantage space out there, it wasn't a surprising document to read. But you know, it certainly peels back the onion of what the general public sees regarding the unbiasedness of it versus the steering of patients for a particular plan for something. So it is unique in that sense. So Wade, I want to get to you for the last piece of this, which is as unfortunately sometimes we get lost in the sauce of reading a 100 or a 200 page filing on a QI-TAM that has been unsealed partially or fully. But you got to take the time to look at some of these things because they do create, they do let you peel back the onion and look behind the curtain of Oz. But what they do is they certainly can give you insight into areas that an investigator may not have known about. And certainly from a payment integrity perspective, are we looking at the things that are coming out in these press releases, right? So final word is, you know, my opinion is don't ignore them. There's valuable information in these things, right? I mean, you pick up tidbits when you look at these things all the time.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be learned from them. Excuse me. And one of the areas when we're talking about the compliance issues there that I thought might be important to bring up too is the importance of the training and education aspect of it. There's certain things that we're seeing in the quotes that are in the QI-TAM and some of the things that they got from emails and things of that nature that should be covered related to what is allowable and what's not. There's a lot of gray areas and kickbacks, there's exceptions, there's business, you know, associate agreement, different types of things. But if that stuff is all laid out in the training and the training is documented and you can have, you know, you have like the slide deck that's used and all the employees took the training, I think that's an important part. And that can be something that SIU, if you're looking at, if you're reading the QI-TAM that's somewhat related to the cases that you're looking at, I guess just to have that aspect of laying out what is allowable and what's not, and basically you're able to check the box that like everybody's taking this training. There shouldn't be a lot of gray areas. Granted, right, you can't cover everything in training, but laying out, you know, what is an exception to the kickback statute, what is not, what is right, allowed, what's not, I think that's an important area. And even looking at these kind of from the outside looking in, as you can make it relate to the cases you're looking at, I think the training and documentation of that training is pretty important.
Yeah, and you know, the takeaway from that is there's some recent court rulings and some new case law that talks about the subjective understanding, right? Sometimes the lawyers will like to use the scienter. What were you thinking at the time? And you know, one of the things that's going on right now is you see in a lot of these cases involving False Claims Act cases is what was the defendant's subjective understanding, which means to an extent you have to climb inside someone's head to understand what they were thinking about at the time that they were doing the thing that they were doing. Very challenging, right? Because how do you know? But when you see things that are so overtly slapping in the face, right? You know, we always talk about text messages and emails are the instances when people speak in unguarded fashions. And so you can get some of that internal thought process from things like text messages and things of that sort. So that's something that you have to consider when you're looking at this. And so, you know, when you're reading these QI-TAM filings, while that's an assessment that someone other than an investigator makes, it certainly can put you into a place to start to look into things like that. Was there training on this? Is the thing that's alleged to be the fraud, waste, or abuse issue something that was covered in a training, similar to when we talk about prior audits and TPE, targeted probe and education. If the provider has been previously educated about something, it's very hard to say, well, I didn't understand, or my subjective understanding was something different, when you've got documents that say that. So that's a great point, Wade, that's part of where you've got to start to look at this. And particularly in the SIU space, like, what is the prior history from a payment integrity, education and training perspective, you know, turn those rocks over to identify where some of that prior history might be. So this is going to be a fascinating case to see where it goes. It just got unsealed. It's out of Boston. Three very large commercial payers who have very large Medicare lines of business. One in particular actually sold off its commercial line of business to focus only on the Medicare space. So it's a really going to be a very interesting case, because these plans are huge. They're national plans. It's going to be interesting to see where it all falls. And the fact that that this case is alleging this on both sides. They've got a QTAM that's alleging the payer side, the broker side, and putting kind of the full story together is really going to be interesting. You can find it online. It's a really interesting read. If you like that, one of the great parts about looking at these QTAMs is that when they do the unsealing, you'll also find a lot of the regulatory language that's in there. So if you are someone who is interested in looking up the regulations that they're saying are being violated, you've got the references there to help you potentially in creating a little bit of a library of future cases to look at. So we're going to keep track of this one. I enjoyed reading it, and I'm going to enjoy following it just to see from that from the regulatory perspective where it all ends up. So we'll keep tracking it and see where it goes. So as always, great to get your perspective on these, Wade, Matt. It's good seeing you guys as always. And again, we enjoy having everybody participate. Got a lot of LinkedIn Lives coming up. Got a lot of things in the hopper for education and training from the OIG podcast, the roundtable perspective, as well as the LinkedIn Live perspective. So again, you can get your newsletter every week at advisehealth.com. You can get the newsletter with a link to the roundtable and all of our other stuff each and every week right into your inbox. Also on LinkedIn, we've been posting, we're introducing a lot of the new people that we're bringing onto the team and some of their backgrounds, and we're bringing in some really qualified people with some great backgrounds. So on LinkedIn, you'll see a lot of the new faces that are coming into Advise as we continue to grow and expand our footprint in the consulting, advisory, and fraud, waste, and abuse compliance space. So thanks again for supporting Advise and for participating, and we'll see you all on the next OIG roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.